So, Harry, could you repeat the question once again, if that's possible?
Sorry, I'm blanking a little bit now. What was I? You were
Yeah,
talking.
I think you are asking about whether you think I have enough information
Right,
now to
right.
be able
You were
to.
saying that when you know, at the time when you started, you felt that the most important thing was, that you needed more information and that there was very little known, especially since the work was being done in the context of climate change. So I was wondering if that had changed now. But we could come back to this later if you think, it comes
No,
better.
that's fine. I think this is as good a time as I need to talk about it.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, this is the big fight I've constantly had with my group, right? They kept thinking that I am non-interventionist, and they do still think that I'm much, much more non-interventionist that they would potentially be. Okay. And for me, one of the central principles that I keep holding very close to me, which the researchers in my group get very upset with, is doubt. Okay. And I think that doubt is central to everything that I do. And as long as doubt doesn't paralyze, I think that it's, I still hold it very dear. And one of the big things about doubt is that intervention is a very, very, it has consequences. And I've always felt that, particularly in relation to these nature-human interfaces, okay, I do not want to be pursuing an intervention that can potentially change the course of the way humans, human societies who have much, much greater agency over the systems that we are studying, okay, it will change the direction that they're taking with the system. And that to some extent could be detrimental. I didn't believe that I had that agency to do it. And that, of course, has been the subject of a huge amount of debate within my program. Okay. And more recently, okay, in the last 4 or 5 years, what I've come to recognize is that there is. It's 9 o'clock. We'll have to wait for the bells. Okay. Sorry about this.
No, no problem. That's a nice feel to the interview.
It does go on a bit. Are we done? Okay, we can try now. It might ring once again.
Once again,
Okay.
okay.
So, in the Lakshadweep, we've been watching the reefs decline. Okay, and at some point, I began to realize that the intervention that I needed to be doing is really not about the coral reef anymore. There's very little that I could potentially do in the coral reef. Okay. I could potentially bend over backwards and say that if we have areas that were completely protected in no-take areas, et cetera, the resilience of the reef to these large-scale disturbance events is potentially maximized, and therefore it would help in the recovery processes, et cetera. And that's likely true, and I could potentially go that direction. But, I'm working on these islands that are just 1 meter above sea level. 70,000 people living on these, densely packed on these islands. And at some point, I realized that, hang on, what we're talking about is the survival of people on these islands. We're talking about, in one generation, having, one of the biggest group of internal migrants moving into the mainland of India, okay, as the first climate refugees in the country. So, I realized that there was a greater responsibility over here, that the responsibility was no longer just to the ecosystem, but really to raise some kind of awareness about the magnitude of this tragedy, okay, that was happening. unfolding so dramatically and so self-evidently for me and for the group. And yet, for the powers that be, and for potentially even the society there, they were largely oblivious of what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I think more recently I felt that it doesn't matter that I don't have all the pieces, I don't have all the information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that it is time to start doing something, perhaps a little too late.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it has also been in response to, to the kinds of developmental pushes that are coming in from the current dispensation. Okay. And so much of the pushback has really been, in response. Again, it's been reactionary, okay, not mm-hmm. been planned in any. But what has been planned is the sense that, just communicating what we've learned about these systems, about the fragility and resilience of these systems, and to say that this is going to affect your lives in very direct ways, in existential ways, in a way that actually in most other parts of most other terrestrial environments, okay, we just don't have. It's not really the magnitude of the problem is not as much.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that's where I am right now. And that's where actually most of my focus is.
So when you
to
say
try and
that,
understand.
Finish.
Yeah, go ahead. No. So the focus right now is really on trying to understand the influence of the declining resilience of the Lakshadweep reefs on on human habitability itself. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think the habitability of these islands is going to be influenced by what's happening in the ecological space, influenced by climate change. And that is the central problem that we want to try to address.
And how recent is this shift in thinking?
I think it'd be the last 4 or 5 years that I've been starting to think.
And when you say, you and your team have started to see signs of what's happening in terms of the effects of climate change and the effects it's likely to have on the people living there. What are some of these signs? Is it what you're seeing happening to the reefs, or is it more than that?
So it's a combination of things, right? So it's not just climate change. It's also what the local change that's happening. And both of these things are coming together at the same time. On the one hand, we've been seeing over the last 25 years that the ecosystem itself is ratcheting down.
Okay.
Each time it declines, it takes some time to recover. Before it is able to recover, it declines once again. And so each time the decline is slightly less each time, which is gives you some sense that this is a system that's probably getting a little bit more resistance. But the recovery is always, it becomes more and more protracted. And it is always truncated. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So the Lakshadweep reefs right now are in a state of constant recovery. Okay, they never have been given enough of a chance to recover. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So each year, when you go back, when I go back, I am holding my breath when I get into the water to see what the reefs are like, and I hold my breath until March or April. Okay, when the sea surface temperatures are rising,
mm-hmm.
and I just hope that it's not El Nino year. Okay, by around December. December or January, I sort of know if there's going to be an El Nino year going to occur, okay? And then I just basically have to track to see whether, whether the reefs are going to die or not, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And every year that we get allows the corals and the reefs to grow slightly better. So, that kind of, we have a constant sense of anxiety that's taking place because of the declining of the reefs. That's one. The second is that we have had an increasing number of these catastrophic storms that are influencing the reef as well. So some of our best reefs, the reefs that have been recovering the best, have suddenly been devastated completely by cyclones like Oki. Okay, just down to less than 2 or 3% of live coral cover within just 2 or 3 days of the cyclone. And all of this is causing, we are noticing coastal erosion around the islands themselves. Okay. Together with that, we have declining freshwater. And the declining freshwater is not merely a result of storms and things like that, but also because of urbanization pressures. You know, many of these places are growing in population and growing in their aspirations and therefore in their freshwater needs and requirements as well. In the capital, for instance, you know, you have appliances that are coming into the system that are that use a huge amount of water, like washing machines, which were never there before. Okay, and all of this in highly water-limited systems. So those changes are they're converging. And one of the things that gave me a sense of complacency all along was the narrative that I had built for myself for my PhD, which is that the fishers of the Lakshadweep have been fishing off in the pelagic waters for tuna, and that gives the reef a huge amount of resilience, which is what I saw the very first time post-1998. And I talked about epiphenomenal conservation, about how, you know, the tuna fishing saves the reef, etc. Those are the kinds of narratives that I was talking about. It made a really nice story. Okay. But there was a flip side to that, and that, which I got to know only much, much later, which is that all traditional institutions, most of the traditional institutions associated with protecting, with managing local resources around the reef, they've been completely eroded if they existed at all. Okay, mm-hmm. And as a result, it only took a small change in these resource relationships. Okay? It only took the arrival of a few collector boats on the mainland with a huge amount of ice for the system to switch completely. And so now what you have is a whole lot of fishermen, you know, rushing to the reef to get fish from the reef and to make a bunch of instant cash, which they sell to the collector boats. And with no traditional institutions to actually regulate this catch, okay, we are seeing an emptying out of the reef. So it's a perfect storm. Okay, on the one hand, you have climate change that is destroying the reef in relation to these major bleaching events. You have a disruption of the oceanographic systems, which is causing storms that are destroying the reef as well. And you have urbanization pressures, okay, which are putting a huge amount of stress on freshwater, as well as you have changes in resource use without the institutions to support it. All of that now is coming to bear on these little islands. Okay, and there's an even further dimension, which is the developmental plans. On top of all of this, you have the government, which wants to bring in, you know, the private players that want to transform the lagoons. They want to transform the islands to make them into major tourism destinations. All of this together, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years, I'm just seeing, you know, there are these from every direction. Okay, you have these threats converging on this little, you know, on these islands of paradise, and. That's what we are trying to address right now.
And you know, you said that the traditional institutions around the reefs are no longer exist. Is that because there hasn't been reef fishing?
So, and this is what I've been saying, that you know, that traditional institutions are like muscle memories. Okay, that they need to be used in order to remain. And with disuse, they go away. So while tuna fishing was fantastic, because it took fishing pressure away from the reef, in two generations, okay, of disuse, whatever traditional systems may have been there, I don't even know if they were there in the past, okay, I don't have any evidence of it, but whatever traditional systems that may have been there don't exist in any meaningful form anymore. Okay, so fishers today, the fishers who are fishing today, don't remember having fished in any other way. Okay, they've always fished. You know, their parents, you know, their fathers or their uncles would be fishing tuna as well, right? Mm-hmm. And so they don't. The often complex knowledge that many reef communities have. Okay, associated with the reef, and the belief systems and the totems and the sacred areas and all the rest of it that you see in many other places across the Pacific, for instance, or even in our work in the Nicobars, okay, it doesn't exist in the Lakshmi. And so that has happened over the last 60 years or so, or a little bit more.
I'll come to the work in the Nicobars in a minute, but I just wanted to ask you, you know, you mentioned a few things that, you know, are happening as a result of climate change. You said coastal erosion, changes in freshwater availability. You've studied what's happening to the coral reefs systematically, quantitatively, through your research. But I was wondering whether the other things that you said about coastal erosion and freshwater availability and all of that, does that come from, you know, just sort of qualitative observations, just spending a lot of time in the area, speaking to people? Is that where this understanding comes from?
So, yeah, I mean, it's a combination of things. So most of our research has been in water, okay? Mm-hmm. But so I was, at one point, I had to speak to, I think it was one of the administrators of the island. And I needed to communicate to him, okay, the full magnitude of this entire, you know, how of all the problems that the Lakshadweep are facing right now. So I'm not sure in which year this was, but I put together a little PowerPoint presentation which I called At All Futures, okay, where the point I made is that, look, that there are multiple futures, you know, that the Lakshadweep can take, and all of these are constrained by certain by certain boundary conditions, okay? Mm-hmm. And in thinking about those boundary conditions and the safe operating spaces, okay, it became clear to me from all my conversations with people, from just my lived experience of living on the islands, okay? Mm-hmm. Depending on where you go on the islands, water becomes very, very limiting. Okay, you go to the southern parts of most islands and you won't get fresh water. Okay, mm-hmm. You go to some islands like Bitra and you wouldn't get fresh water at all. I mean, the water is sulfuric. Okay, you can use it in a pinch, but it's really, really, it's vile, the water. And so, and every time from the time, you know, from before the monsoons is the time when you have the worst amount of water stress. So all of these are factors that, you know, that having lived on the islands, okay, it's something that you get to understand. So I put this presentation together, which is At All Futures, and I linked both food, water, and shelter to the stability of the reefs. And I said that, you know, if you are thinking about preserving the biosecurity of the islands, okay, you really need to think about the resilience of the reef, because biosecurity, which is land, water, and shelter, okay, all come, well, land, water, and food, all of them are linked to the reef. And all of those are right now unraveling. That presentation, I didn't know it at the time, but that presentation became almost a kind of research agenda. Mm-hmm. Trying to understand, you know, where the Lakshadweep is going in relation to each of these things. I made that presentation based largely on, you know, on my intuition and basically what I'd been seeing and experiencing and conversations with people on the islands. But more recently, what we've been doing, none of this is published yet, but we have been trying to understand water in a really big way. We are trying to get some understanding of coastal erosion. Okay. We are trying to understand the link between reef growth, okay, and these processes. So right now we're trying to put all the pieces together that first came about in that one little presentation that I put together for one of the administrators. Since then, that presentation has evolved a bit, and I've been giving it to pretty much everyone, okay, that I meet, anyone who cares to listen, okay, and wherever I go. If I'm traveling on a ship and I meet someone who is interested, I pull out the presentation and I say, yeah, listen. Okay, or local panchayats, I go and I say, yeah, listen, okay, this is what is happening to your islands. The future of the islands is in your hands. But I have very little of that information as in terms of data. And what we're trying to do now is to fill in the pieces in terms of information. Hari, I think I've lost you again.
And I can hear you now.
Okay. Yeah. Hi. Hi.
You said you, where I lost you is where you're saying that you give this presentation to everyone, but you started saying you have very little.
I have very little of the information, okay, to validate every bit of that large framework. And what we're trying to do over the last 4 or 5 years is to build a program that, where every bit of the program focuses on getting solid information around every one of those issues that I brought about in the in that one presentation.
Mm-hmm. You said you don't remember when, but approximately last 5 years, last 10 years, when you first made this presentation to the bureaucrat?
I think it was, it could be 2016. Yes, I think it was 2016. And the reason it I know it was 2016 is that that was when we had a major, another major bleaching event. And what I was seeing was this, I know, it was a sense of panic almost, that here is that these reefs have just been destroyed by the 2010 event, and they're just more or less recovering from that. And 2016 was going to be another major bleaching year. And at that point, I went to this frenzy of talking to as many people as I possibly could, telling them about the state of the reef, what was going to happen, and what eventually did happen. Okay. So around 2016 is when I started making those presentations.
Yeah. I want to now talk to you about the Nicobar work and, you know, work in other areas. And I want, you know, we could spend an entire session talking about from, you know, the Nicobar work and your work in the Mediterranean. But I really see the work in the Lakshadweep as what's been the core of your work in terms of how long you've continued working there. And I want to, I'm interested in asking you how these other pieces of work have, you know, influenced the way you think about Lakshadweep. And the last time we spoke, you did say that Manish's work in the Nicobar has really got you to think about human nature interactions differently. And I was wondering whether you could talk a little bit about how that work has influence the way you think about the Lakshadweep Islands and, you know, the human nature interactions in the Lakshadweep Islands.
So I think, you know, for me, Manish's thesis was quite special. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think we mentioned this before as well, that it's a body of work that challenged me both intellectually and in other much, much more fundamental ways. I mean, Manish Chandi is one of the keenest ethnographers I know, you know, and he made his sheer humanity was central to the intellectual work he put into his thesis. Okay, so it was after the tsunami. Manish had lost many, many dear friends from the Nicobar Islands, okay, because he'd been living in the Nicobars on and off, doing various small bits of work, and at the time of the tsunami, he lost many people who were really, really close to him. Mm-hmm. And he kept going back to try and see how he could help, etc. And in the years after the disaster, what Manish saw was the communities he loved, they were coming apart as they tried to put their lives back together again. And he just saw them just coming apart. You know, many people's, lots of lives lost, you know, the houses and plantations were destroyed. Their reefs were in a miserable state. You know, they had pigs were extremely important to them, and virtually no community had any pigs left as a result of the tsunami. You know, not that they have any chickens, not that they have any ducks. All the things that were vital to them to the community were lost. And of course, to compound the problem, there was this huge tsunami of aid, which we call the second tsunami. The tsunami of all this money that was being poured into the islands, okay, and it brought a whole new set of challenges. You know, all of a sudden the old ways were eroding, and with it, you know, there was a whole lot of tensions that were rising up that were not there before. You know, there were tensions over resources, about decision making over these resources. Okay, there were tensions between tradition and modernity. Okay, between the young and the old. You know, and you know, suddenly, you know, what language you spoke became a critical mediator of power. Okay, so whether you spoke Hindi or not became extremely important. because all the administrators who were brought in from outside were people who spoke Hindi. And therefore, as you can imagine, you know, the old village elders who previously held the community together didn't speak the language anymore. And the young, these young bucks were suddenly becoming the people who everyone relied on. And that changed power relations dramatically. Okay. And so this was really, in many ways, an existential fight for what meant to be a Nicobari. So what Manish noticed, and he, when he, in conversations that we were having each time he came back, was that when he visited his friends on these different islands, that each community was dealing with these tensions in slightly different ways. Okay, so there were clearly some communities that were dealing much better than others, okay, which were much, much more resilient to change. And so, you know, when I forced him to do a PhD, okay, this is not something that he wanted to do ever, but I said, Manish, these are fascinating insights. They need to be documented in a way, they, you know, for the sake of the island themselves. And so I think the PhD is a very good, you know, disciplinary framework within which you can do this. So he's not convinced at all, but we forced him to do it. And so what his thesis became, you know, it became a way of trying to unpack the differences in resilience between these, you know, that these communities took in relation to this catastrophe. And for me, intellectually, this was just a problem of community ecology. You know, it was transmuted onto human societies, but it's a problem of human society, of community ecology eventually. And so, you know, what we did was that we used some of Bob Bain's ideas, okay, mm-hmm. of how community was structured, okay, particularly the ideas of the keystone species, okay, to figure out if we could, that can be used to understand how communities in Nicobars used and managed their resources, and how changes in those relationships related to changes in community organization. Okay, so we were saying that, okay, there could be ecologically keystone species, but are there culturally keystone species? Okay. Species or resources that were disproportionately important to their abundance. Okay, as simple as that. Taking exactly the same idea of the ecological keystone and transforming, putting it onto the system. And I think it was a very powerful framework. What we were saying is that, okay, you had a whole bunch of cultural keystones, a whole bunch of cultural dominance, and a whole bunch of abundance species. Okay, dominant species are ones that were extremely important to the community, but were also quite, you know, they were abundant in the environment, as opposed to keystones, which are not abundant at all but extremely important, okay, compared to the abundant resources, which are not very not highly useful. And what we hypothesized was that these three different types of resources would be managed in slightly different areas, different ways, okay, that dominant resources would be managed with some form of common property, okay, through increasing rules of common property, okay, but you know, and the completely abundant resources would tend to be more and more open access, okay, with very few rules associated with them. But as species became more, as resources became more and more keystone, okay, we would expect them to become more and more privatized, okay. Mm-hmm. What we hypothesized was that what the tsunami did was that it completely, you know, it changed around these relationships. It, you know, it changed the abundance of the resources on the one hand, and it changed the importance of these resources as well. And so what we would expect to see was that, depending on how this has changed, we would expect to see resources that were once community owned becoming more and more privatized. Okay, as they moved from dominant to keystone. Okay, and so we use that as a kind of predictive framework. It is, I think, a very powerful one, and I think that it is one of those ideas that has not been explored enough. And I think that, you know, it's one of those things that I certainly would like to try and do in other you know, simple societies. Okay,
what would an example of such a resource be that moved from being dominant to keystone after? Okay.
So things like, you know, coconut plantations, okay,
Mm-hmm.
or plantations of trees, which were used for building boats. Okay, at one point they were relatively abundant, but after the tsunami, because they lost such a lot, okay, they became more and more. You know, very very few boats were around, and very few trees to make boats were around. And so previously there were complex rules of how they shared those resources. Okay, but after the tsunami, people became much much more private about how they. So they, you know, it was impossible to get access to a tree. Okay, and so that's one of the examples. But there are several of them like that. Okay, that became increasingly privatized. Now, and as it became more and more private property, okay, from community, from a common property to private property, okay, there was an increasing individualization of the community. Okay,
mm-hmm.
These are communities that were based very, very much on kinship relationships and things like that. Well, not kinship, but some these relationships of that they built within their common kitchens. Okay, and those relationships are becoming much, much more nuclear now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was causing a breakdown in many of the communities, and not all. Okay, so those that was one particular example, but it can give you any more.
Mm-hmm. And sorry, did you want to add something to this when I...
Yeah, so I was bringing all these ideas to Manish's study from community ecology and from biology, okay, because I was using the frameworks that I knew and trying to put them onto essentially an anthropological piece of work. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But what Manish was bringing to it was something altogether different. I think his philosophy did not allow him to separate his study from lived experience. And like mm-hmm. he's a good anthropologist, he lived the lives of the people of Nicobas. You know, he was convinced that that was the only way that you could understand what they were going through. And that was new for me. And it was, to some extent, pretty frustrating. I mean, I remember this one conversation. We were in Chaura, you know, and with all my training, the only way I could think of understanding these processes that were happening was in collecting data with things that I could measure. So we designed questionnaires that Manish could conduct, trying to understand the value, the abundance of these different resources. We wanted people to rank them, et cetera, et cetera. We were going to these different stakeholders. We had to go to these different stakeholders and interview them. So, you know, I was keen that Manish had a reasonable sample size, okay, so mm-hmm. that we could analyze them in some kind of semi-quantitative way. So in the morning, we went to this, you know, the house of this wonderful old lady, and we spent, you know, we went there, and I thought that we'd do several interviews through that day, but no, we sat down with this wonderful old lady. She gave us tea, then we spent a long time just chatting about how her, you know, how her brother was and how her children, her grandchildren were, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We finally landed up having lunch, and sometime around 3 or 4 o'clock, I said, Manish, we have to do the interview, right? And so, yeah, so he did the interview, and we sat and did the interview, and it went really well. Then we went back, but that was the only interview we did in a single day. So that evening, I had a long chat with Manish, and I said, you know, I told him about sample sizes and interview discipline and thematic analysis and all these things. And he listened very patiently and finally said, you know, Rohan, you want your questionnaires, so I'll get them. But I'm trying to understand something else. I'm trying to understand the community itself. Okay, you are merely trying to get your questionnaires and your sample sizes. Okay, and there was a strong difference in our approaches, and I think that it frustrated me at the time, but I began to understand it in time. And I guess Manish's approach to his work taught me, I think, what lies beyond the reach of what we can measure with our vernier calipers. Okay, and I think it's not merely in understanding peoples and societies that this is important. You know, of course, in peoples and societies, this is critical. Okay, but I see that more and more we are given up so completely to the tyranny of measurement. Okay, and what we can do, you know, with things that we can measure, that we become a slave to these instruments. Okay, and we become a slave to the least count of those instruments as well. You know, we forget that those instruments have a certain lease count, and there are things that fall between the cracks that we just don't know. Okay. And we've given up, I think, the space for a certain amount of ecological intuition, which comes with a kind of lived experience of being in an ecosystem. And I think that's what I myself am trying to reclaim. You know, in the reefs of the Lakshadweep, you know, I'll always be an alien. But I want to be as close as possible to be a participant observer. I know it's an impossible task. I'm not a fish, I'm not a coral, you know, I'm not a sea slug. But, you know, is it possible to be the life of the reef somehow, to understand it from within? And, you know, even though it's impossible, there are some reefs in the Lakshadweep that I know so well after all these years that I sometimes succumb to the hubris of believing that I might actually understand it. Okay. Of course, there are small moments, and then I go back to my tape measure and my quadrat and start taking photos. But it's a long-term goal trying to. So if you were asking me what kind of influence Manish had, I think it was making me aware that there's more things that drive social systems as well as ecological systems than we can ever measure.
Rohan, quick time check.
Would
you want to end here, or would you like to? We have the time to
take another question. Yeah, we could end over here if that's possible. If you think this is a natural break, we could end over here.
I wanted to ask you a similar question about, you know, the work you've been doing in the Mediterranean and, you know, the work you've been doing with Teresa, but that's fine. You know, anyway, all of this is going to be put together, so we could start the next session with that. It's fine.
I could take that one question and then we can wrap up perhaps if you would like.
It's related to this, and the question is again, you know, about you starting to work in a new system, which I'm guessing is very different from the system you're most familiar with, and also starting to work with people from a different academic culture in Spain. I was wondering again, you know, in what ways, looking back, you think that has influenced the way you think about your own work in the Lakshadweep?
So, I mean, my work in the Mediterranean has all been done together with Teresa, my wife, Teresa Alcoverro. Okay. And if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be working in the Mediterranean. And so we work very, very closely together. Okay. And I think working with Teresa over the last two decades has been quite a revelation. And I would say this upfront, that not many couples can work together. And I don't actually recommend it. I think it makes a work-life balance much more difficult to achieve. You know, and drawing boundaries between the professional and the personal, you know, can be very challenging. But I think that in Teresa, I have a person who complements many of the things that I lack in being a scientist. She is systematic when I am messy. She understands study design in ways that I cannot, or it cannot be bothered. Okay, she is numerically much, much more literate than I am, you know, and what we share, I think, is the ability to see patterns and to, you know, to we're able to look at the system and intuit some kind of processes that are there in the field, and both of us see it. And that's, I think, what holds us together, the one skill that we have. But I think Teresa's most fantastic skill is the ability to find elegant and often completely unconventional ways of measuring these processes. Okay, she'll see a process, both of us will see the process, but what she'll come up with is, how about we measure this process like this? Okay, and that's often difficult. Okay, and if I, you know, I'm much, much more scared about these. I'm much more bound by the rule book when it comes to these measurements. And Teresa is happy to make it up as it goes along, and actually works out quite well. Okay, so I think that between both of us, things work more or less. I mean, we argue a lot, and for many newcomers in the group, that can be a little intimidating. But I think what we've realized is that creativity is actually born of conflict. Okay, ideas occur through dialogue and through opposition. Okay, if you have everyone agreeing with you all the time, you don't have new ideas. Okay, and so that opposition and dialogue is extremely important for us. Okay, and as a process, I think it works really well. So, I think to answer your question about the work in the Mediterranean, for me, it's a playground. It really is a playground. Okay. For several reasons. I mean, the systems are ridiculously simple. I mean, one species of seagrass sometimes becoming, you know, two, okay, and very, very rarely three species of seagrass. Okay, there's one herbivorous fish for the most part. Okay, so you have one seagrass, one herbivorous fish, two herbivorous sea urchins. Okay, virtually no large predators to speak of. It's such a simplified system. It's like a cartoon of an ecosystem, right? And as a result, it is, you know.
Sorry, Rohan. Sorry to interrupt, but I think there was again a break in the connection. I heard you saying that it's very simple. That is, you know, at max three species, and I didn't hear what you said after that.
I'm saying that it has one species of seagrass, okay, for the most part. You have one herbivorous fish, okay, for the most part, and you have two species of herbivorous sea urchin, okay, mm-hmm. and almost no large predators. So what you're seeing is a kind of cartoon version of an ecosystem, mm-hmm. right? It's the closest you can get to something, you know, something you can draw on a whiteboard and say, you know, imagine, you know, one primary producer, you know, two consumers, and one is a fish, one is a sea urchin. And so you can get to do a whole lot of these other studies on species interactions and functions in a way that would be just too bloody complex to do in a, you know, even in a depauperate coral reef, even in a reef that's been, you know, battered by multiple bleaching events and destroyed by fishing, etc. It would still be much too complex. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the Mediterranean offers you this playground. Okay. And that's what I've been using it as. Okay. And of course, I don't lead the work here. I participate in it, and I think it's really very, for me, it's great. It's almost like a bit of a sabbatical that I take each year. Okay. The other reason that it is a playground is that honestly, the stakes are pretty low. Mm-hmm. Okay. Human dependence is not a question of life or death over here. You know, and yes, climate change is affecting these systems. Exotic species are pouring in from the Red Sea and transforming these ecosystems. But, you know, I think like Europe itself, the Mediterranean is a post-decadent place. It's a post-decadent sea. It's a nature after nature, if you know what I mean. Okay. You know, after you've gotten rid of all your dangerous large creatures, you know, after you've fished it to death, you've tamed the waters, you've reduced it to its bare essentials, then you can think of protecting the few small rocks that remain within protected marine protected areas and declare the rest of the sea as a recreation area for tourists and locals. Okay. So freed from this great urgency or moral imperative, you know, the science you do can be real fun. And, you know, that's slightly cynical way of looking at it, but you know, that is what the work in the Mediterranean is for me. You know, after all the eschatological gloom that I have to deal with in the Lakshadweep, you know, it really is a relief to get back to this old sea which has no tides and explore how fish behave or how the urchins respond to fear, etc., etc. So the work in the Lakshadweep in the Mediterranean is for me is that, if I'm really honest.
But in the contrast with Lakshadweep, are there learnings for Lakshadweep?
Oh, yes, I think so. I mean, and I think, you know, I keep making these little forays to other places, but Lakshadweep for me is my intellectual home, right? And so every time I go out, I bring back these little things from, and I think the one thing that I've learned through working with the group here in Spain is the value of, even in asking very complex questions, to breaking it down and making them as simple as possible. Designing field-based experiments, whatever you do, you know, in all this while in the Lakshadweep, we've been largely based on just mostly descriptive kind of studies, okay, looking at changes through time, and expecting us to get some kind of a, expecting the system to throw up some kind of a, response to the to our vague questions. But that slight rigor in the way in asking the question and the way and simplifying the system as much as possible, trying to design experiments as best as we can within field conditions. Those are the things that I've certainly learned from working in the Mediterranean and working with Teresa's group. That's one. I think that that there's a certain pragmatic quality to work that is done over here, mm-hmm. which I have been able to take over to the Lakshadweep week as well. Okay, to design studies as bite-sized pieces of work. Okay, while you have this huge grand thing that's happening over 25, 30 years. Okay, also to try and break it down into smaller bits, to try to think a little bit more carefully about mechanism, about process and mechanism. All of these things, I think I've learned from, and I don't think it's a one-way thing. I think that it goes back and forth. Okay, it's a more of a dialogue that happens between the work that we're doing in the Lakshadweep and the work that happens in the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Rohan, I think this is a good place to stop. And I wanted to ask you a similar sort of question more broadly about, the other kinds of places you worked and kinds of questions you've asked. But we could take that up in the next session. We could start with that in the next session. So I'll just stop the recording. Sure. And we can just continue to chat for a couple of minutes.